The following is brought to you by Will Harris, Dustin Campbell, Daily Tech News Show, Andy Beach, Nick Wood, and Craig.
Politics, 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 politics.
Hello and welcome everybody to the Politics, Politics, Politics program for April 15th, 2022. Your old pal Justin Robert Young joining you in Austin, Texas. This is going to represent our tax day episode. Yes, it is not due until next Monday, but for many people, either you have filed your taxes, you are thinking about your taxes, or you are about to file your taxes. And so later in this episode, we are going to be joined by Andrew Heaton, one of our favorites. And we are going to talk not only about tax anxiety, tax emotions, tax philosophy, and we'll even get into a little bit of real politics as to whether or not we will ever see tax reform, and if so, what it would be. We're also going to talk about inflation. Inflation is real, my friends, and it hit its worst year-over-year increase in March. However, in the very crevices of that very consumer price index report, there are some bright spots? Three question marks? They're at least not total darkness. We will evaluate them and we'll see whether or not there's something that the Biden administration should actually celebrate or maybe just thank the Lord that there is a moment of respite in the unrelenting beating that they are taking when it comes to inflation. I'm also going to bring you a very interesting story. One that I can't remember a comp for, and neither can some of the reporters that are covering it. There is a congressman who has a day job. Not one of these nominal, like, oh, I also am a doctor or a lawyer or something, but they're like not practicing. No, this dude actually works. He is a commercial airline pilot, and there's a lot of questions as to exactly whether or not that is appropriate and how much he's actually working. Because by the way, he hasn't voted in person in Washington, D.C. for over 3 months. We will not only bring you all of that story, but also some justification as to why he's even taking this risk. Before we start with any of this, though, I want to bring you this little follow-up on something that we did on Wednesday's show where we talked about Maggie Hassan in New Hampshire, one of the embattled Democrats in the Senate, who, by the way, is polling better than a few others. One of those others is Mark Kelly. So as Maggie Hassan went down to the border, despite the fact that she's representing New Hampshire, you had to imagine that some of the folks who are representing cities closer to the border, like Mark Kelly in Arizona, would do the same. Well, we've got some news on that. But first, I'm going to play you an ad that Mark Kelly released. And I want you to go ahead, just like that Raphael Warnock ad we played a few weeks ago, go ahead and try to find what's missing in this ad.
Compared to Congress, the way NASA operates might seem kind of upside down. Putting the mission first, working as a team, and getting the job done no matter what. But really, isn't it Washington that has things upside down? I'm doing things differently. I don't take a dime of corporate PAC money. I publish my schedule online so you know exactly what I'm working on. And I put aside the party politics so we can accomplish results together. I'm Mark Kelly and I approve this message.
Yep. No mention of Joe Biden. No mention of any other prominent Democrat. No real mention of the Democratic Party. In fact, at the end, when he says that I work hard to find solutions for everybody, bipartisan, flashes on the screen. I'm telling you, as somebody who watches these ads and takes them not as, you know, an exact prescription for what they want everybody to believe, but certainly a sign of what the internal self-confidence of a campaign is, that's a pretty interesting one. But first, the Consumer Price Index is out for March, and it's bad. So bad that the Biden administration is blaming Putin.
A lot of it has to do with Vladimir Putin. The reality is that Russia is one of the three largest oil producers in the world. And the fact that they have started this conflict, invaded a foreign country, and they are such a big producer of oil in the world is the reason why the global oil markets are disturbed right now and why your gas prices are going up.
You know, I wonder at what point there just became this philosophy within the Democratic Party where there's just like a red box and a sign above it that says, when in trouble, break glass for excuse. And it's just Russia behind it. But the glass isn't there anymore because it's been shattered so many times. And granted, look, the fact that Vladimir Putin has initiated an invasion in a sovereign nation in Ukraine certainly gives them a lot more cover to, you know, blame their farts on the dog compared to, let's say, during the 2016 election. So the reason that Jen Psaki, White House press secretary and soon to be MSNBC host, is doing social media videos about this very subject is because the Biden administration is doing their best to get ahead of a very, 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 very bad news situation for them. Inflation continues to surge. Real quick reminder on why inflation matters. Inflation matters because every single time that you spend money and you remember that it is more than it used to be, you want to blame somebody. The person that you tend to blame is in the White House or a member of the party for which the president is representing. So this is a constant pain point. This isn't a philosophical thing. This is a pebble in your shoe. And the further you walk with it, the worse it gets. How bad? Well, according to the CPI, inflation rose 8.5% year on year in March, the highest since 1981. Despite the fact that the economy otherwise is doing good, we have very low unemployment and wages continue to go up. Inflation has outpaced these gains, representing less take-home pay for folks who have gotten better jobs and money, not to mention those of us who haven't. The economy is, poll after poll, the number one issue on voters' minds. And Republicans, by the way, have wasted no time pinning the rise in prices on the Biden administration. But in my opinion, that's good practice politically for them, but it's not necessarily needed. No one likes leadership if the money is screwed up. And right now, the money's screwed up. But wait a minute. I'm not just here to dump a load of horse poop on the Biden administration like so many tumbling logs onto Biff Tannen at the end of Back to the Future. No. I've got some bright spots in this new report. I mean, bright, maybe a little bright, dimmer than the brighter that you would want to be. I don't know why I'm Jerry Lewis all of a sudden. Bright, maybe. Bright in quotes. Bright in scare quotes. Now, while food and gas prices remained extraordinarily high in March, the core inflation number, which is everything else but those items, food and gas, did begin to slow for the first time. Now, not recede, and these are year-on-year numbers, by the way, not recede. They haven't gone back down. They just didn't explode as fast as they had the month before. You might be saying in your head, Justin, this is a piss poor example of good news, and I would agree. But in these trying times for the Biden administration, you know, you take what you can get. There is also one technical, if a bit dystopian, piece of good news for the White House. And that is that inflationary prices have spiked for about a year now, which means that since the CPI numbers that tend to get reported and covered the most are the year-on-year increases, that we're probably going to see lower numbers than we're seeing right now from here on out, only because the increases have already been high a year ago. It's been growing for a year. So you're not going to see headlines like, this is the largest inflationary spike since the Reagan administration, because it's gone on for so long. So, like, yes, everyone's still going to be mad because prices are really high, but the headlines will look better. Hopefully. I mean, if they don't, we're really screwed. So those are, look, you can work with those, I guess, if you're the Biden administration, but one way or another, look, there's a reason why I keep playing these ads from Kelly and Warnock, is because they are getting their ass kicked on the number one issue that their voters care about. That's brutal for them. Brutal. So that's the reason why Mark Kelly is going to remind you that he's an astronaut and not that, like, since Mark Kelly's been in the Senate, he's been the staunch warrior for Joe Biden. It's the reason why he's going to say bipartisan and not Democrat, because he wants to trade on the fact that his positives right now are that he is looked at as a nice guy and he is willing to cross the aisle. Now, not Kyrsten Sinema willing to cross the aisle, which makes you wonder about the idea that she's going to get primaried. But right now, the guy who's trying to save his job desperately, short of the NASA thing, is running an ad that Kyrsten Sinema might run. Makes you think, IMO. So here's a fun story for a Friday. Kai Kahele is one of the two congressional representatives in the House of Representatives from Hawaii. He took Tulsi Gabbard's seat when she left Congress. You know, as far as national elected representatives go, it's a pretty sweet gig when you think about it. Be a D.C. muckety-muck part of the year, and then when you have to go press the flesh with the folks back home, you get to do it in Hawaii. Here is Kai recognizing Hawaiian Language Month on the floor of Congress.
Aloha, Mr. Speaker. I rise this morning to honor Mahina Olelo Hawaii, or Hawaiian Language Month. Colleagues, I have the wonderful privilege of being Native Hawaiian. My culture has served as a guiding light throughout my entire life, a light that has survived because of the many kupuna, our elders, who protected this light and who protected our native indigenous language. For Native Hawaiians and so many other indigenous peoples, our language is essential for our people to live and thrive.
I play you him speaking in Congress because he hadn't been there in a while. Kai has been voting by proxy for the last few months. Now, this in and of itself isn't wrong. You're allowed to do it. This came with some of the changes with COVID. And part of that time that he has been out is pretty curious. He's been doing a day job, flying planes for Hawaiian Airlines. Wait, what? Congressmen have day jobs? Yes. This dude flies A330s. I don't know the exact way to say it. I ain't exactly a plane head. He does it for Hawaiian Airlines. According to his official bio, he flies both domestic and international. So he's obviously not keeping it hidden. It's in his bio. What's the problem then? Well, the reason you don't hear Congress folk having day jobs is because there is a cap on how much they are allowed to make from side gigs. Specifically, it's around $29,000. Beyond that, you have to get it cleared by the House Ethics Committee. And after Punchbowl News chased this story down, the representative's office proved that they did indeed have such a waiver. Quote Punchbowl's reporting. Late Tuesday evening, Kahele's office sent us an email exchange between Christine Wagner, Kahele's chief of staff, and Tom Russ, staff director of the Ethics Committee. The two recounted a conversation Kahele had with ethics staffers in December 2020 before Kahele was sworn in, where Ethics Committee staff suggested it would be okay for him to continue to fly for Hawaiian. Company officials were involved in one conversations with ethics officials and Kahele. Okay, so seems a bit unorthodox, but still a little weird. And here's another reason why it's weird. Kahele is on the aviation panel of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, which oversees the airline industry for the federal government, for which he is an employee of both. In fact, he has co-sponsored bills that are officially lobbied for by his employer, Hawaiian Airlines. Now, here's what Kahele's spokesperson told Punchbowl. Quote, there are also misleading reports concerning Congressman Kahele's outside nerd income as a commercial pilot. The congressman's outside employment is in accordance with rules set by the U.S. House Ethics Committee. In 2022, all members of the U.S. House, including Congressman Kahele, are limited to earning $29,895 or less from all outside earned income sources. In 2022, Congressman Kahele has flown three flights for a total of 14.2 flying hours and has earned $2,861.90. In 2021, the congressman's outside earned income was $29,151.79. The congressman brings a unique perspective to the T&I committee as a current and qualified U.S. commercial air transport pilot and strengthens the voices of all pilots, cabins, crew, and air cargo operators at home in Hawaii and throughout the United States. Okay, so we know that they are very, very focused on the idea that he has not made more money than the ethics cap says he should, and they seem to dance around the idea that maybe it's a conflict of interest for him to draw a paycheck from a private company and a, you know, while he is co-sponsoring legislation that these, that the same company has lobbied for. But it makes you wonder, why even try? You know, it'd be one thing if he were secretly serving on a board or having a bunch of money put into a trust because he is representing the interest of one thing or another. But this does seem to just kind of be the highest end version of a workaday gig. Is being a pilot super therapeutic for him? Is he just really excited about all the destinations that Hawaii Airlines can serve? Well, I did a little digging. One of the most loyal listeners to this show is a fine man by the name of Just Another Pilot. And guess what? He's just another pilot. So I asked him a few pilot questions about this. Here's what he came back to me with. First things first, if you are a pilot, then the biggest thing that matters to you is seniority. Whether or not you're in a union, pilots choose an airline that they are going to fly with, and they keep doing it forever. This is not like any other gig. Like in the tech industry, people go from Uber to Apple to their own startup, back to Amazon. Like, people switch jobs constantly because you don't lose any status. In fact, you can be greatly rewarded by going from one company to another. And ultimately, even more rewarded if you flirt with going to another company. Not so in the airline game. The second that you leave one company for another, all of your seniority's gone. And the way it was described to me is it basically puts a bullet in the head of your career. So if you are somebody that likes being a congressman, but also doesn't want to bet his entire existence on, this gig where you can get kicked out every 2 years, then maybe you do want to keep the lights on for your career piloting the skyways. So let's say that's the plan. You want to just put your career as a pilot on the back burner, but you don't want to quit and you don't want to change airlines. Well, what do you do? Here's what Just Another Pilot said. Wide body guys, which is what this Congressman Kahele is, might fly 12 hours and there are three or four pilots per flight. They land once. Each pilot needs three landings in 90 days to keep your certification. So if you're only flying two trips a month, that's four opportunities for guys to land, or four, depending on the contract. Four opportunities to land for three guys. So if a guy is flying two a month, he's getting one landing a month, and in 90 days, he'll get his three landings. If a pilot, that is what he said. And by the way, let's go back to his response. Kahele's spokesman response says he's flown three flights in total for 14.2 flying hours. So he obviously is not doing the most of those, or the longest of those routes, but still, he took three flights, and we don't know whether or not he was allowed to land for all three or one, or how many more he has planned going forward. So what happens if a pilot doesn't land three times in 90 days? Now, the company can still choose to keep them on, but if they want to get back in the air, they'll have to go through a flight simulator, which can cost the airline up to $10,000. Although, if you're Hawaiian Airlines, considering this dude is a congressman who can help pass laws that benefit you, maybe that is indeed a worthwhile expense. This is a fun story. Something that I really hope to keep a bit of an eye on. And also, man, anybody who's challenging for his seat, what amazing commercials you could put together for this. If you would like to support this show, head on over to TakePoliticsSeriously.com. I'm out in Ohio next weekend. We're chasing down Mandel. We're chasing down Gibbons. We are gonna get some vibe checks for this primary season, this midterm primary season. And I'm only doing any of it because of you. You, the listener. First things first. If you do not have the scratch to support us monetarily, I understand it. If you could just do me a favor and on the podcatcher of your choice this week, head on over there and give us a rating. You have no idea how much it helps. That's social proof. And periodically, we have to just make a push on it because I don't want to hit you with the same,
like and subscribe
every single week, because I think people, it just gets a little droney. But I do want you guys to understand that having new and a volume of ratings really does matter in this very weird podcasting game where there is no discoverability. Second, if you would like to support us with a financial donation, the best place to do it is TakePoliticsSeriously.com, because that's where you get bonus content. That's where you're going to get the Thursday show. That's where you're going to get the Sunday show. Both of those, this upcoming week, will have stuff live from Ohio. So there. Everybody, just understand. That is, you're going to get really, really, really good access. So head on over there now. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Bonus content starts at the $3 level. Thank you, thank you, thank you very much to everybody who has already done it. I don't know about you guys, but money is very weird to me. I'm not great with it. My family didn't have a ton of it. I tend to get startled when I see it accumulate, and I get mad when I see it go. And so therefore, taxes have been something that have been a bit of a bugaboo for me. And with tax season upon us and tax day coming up on Monday, I felt I needed to talk to somebody that I know, somebody that's a good friend. And so we welcome the one, the only, the host from the Political Orphanage, Andrew Heaton. Welcome back to the show, Andrew.
I am delighted to be here. We are recording this first thing in the morning for me. You've probably already eaten lunch, but for me, this is first thing in the morning. And what a great way to kick off my day by talking about taxes with my good friend, Justin Robert Young.
Have you done your taxes yet?
I have not done my taxes yet. I don't want to reveal too much of the Heaton financial portfolio, but I own like 2% of a duplex in some county named after an amphibian in eastern Oklahoma. It literally makes enough money to pay for the taxes on the duplex. But the papers always come to me sometime in June. So it's just enough that I always have to fill out all this additional stuff. So I've not done anything yet.
I found out this morning that my wife believed that tax day was in March and we had just been late for the entire time that we filed joint taxes.
That's great. No, that's the equivalent. Like sometimes a spouse will be like, honey, we have to leave at 8 p.m. We have to leave at 8 p.m. knowing that we're going to leave at 8:30, but we really have to leave at 9 p.m. So you've got that going with tax filing of like, we're already pretty behind. I got to get that K-1 from you.
Yeah, basically. I mean, like, I guess also it's because she's far more responsible than I am. And she, you know, had always filed her taxes when she was single in March and just assumed that it was in March. But we have odd, although you're only a few years into the full 1099 doing your own taxes.
Yeah, I'm
lifestyle,
three years into this. And what I've learned is that I can legally and ethically write off quite a lot of my income as a self-employed individual, but that comes around and it bites you on the other end, because when I try to get a mortgage for a house, the bank's like, oh, you're poor. And I'm like, I'm not poor. I'm thinking like a Koch brother and writing off all of this stuff. But they're like, yeah, we're looking at your income though. And I'm like, okay, look, I'm not saying I wrote off stuff I shouldn't have written off. What I'm saying is I'm very good at identifying things related to my job that I might have otherwise already done. For instance, like if I'm traveling to another city and I'm going to do shows there, that's a tax deductible expense. But now the plane flight's tax deductible. I get a per diem for the week I'm gone, all these things, but nothing. So anyway, for anybody that's mad at me for writing off a significant amount of my taxes, know that I cannot purchase a house, which is the single greatest vehicle for wealth accumulation in the United States. I am locked in as a permanent renter.
Have you found that to be a stressful thing? Because I found, and I've been doing the 1099 thing for quite a while, even while I was a W-2 employee for a brief period for about 5-6 years, I still was making a significant amount of money on, you know, the podcasting stuff that I always wound up owing. I don't think I can remember the last time that I got a refund, but that is definitely a jarring a jarring moment when you go from tax day being that time I get a lump sum of money to that time that I need to write a check that I was never. You might be financially prepared for it. You are never emotionally prepared to write the checks that you need to write as a 1099 person.
What do you do? Because what I do is I just take like 20% of all of my Patreon checks and I put them in like a tax account with my bank so that I've got a big and then I also at the beginning of the year just give a bunch of money to the IRS so that I'm not that surprised when the bill comes around. I assume you're setting money aside as the year progresses, right? Because that would be terrifying to get that bill at the end. I don't want to deal with that because I am not that responsible.
No, I'm. You might be financially more closer to a Coke brother. I am more financially like a Coke dealer in that I just hope to have the pile of money when I need to start moving it around. I've gotten better. The financial planning is not a natural strong suit of mine, but I have gotten better at squirreling away money away from myself.
See, that's the trick.
But also, here's the other problem though: is I also have Mint, which tracks all of my money. And so I see a big number in Mint, but like that takes away the point of squirreling it away from myself because I keep seeing it.
So what I've done, both my finances and my health are both contingent on me being an idiot with poor willpower. That's why I don't keep liquor in the home because I'll drink it way too fast. That's why I don't keep ice cream in my house because I'll eat it because I'm a moron. I buy a lot of fruit because so when I get that craving, I go, I'll eat the mango first, then I'll get the ice cream. And then I'm done with it. And I'm like, I'm just going to go to sleep. And with finances, I got Capital One years ago. They let you have all these sub accounts and I have it just automatically deduct things in there. So like here's a good example. It puts away like $20 a month for Valentine's Day or whatever, because I realized when I lived in New York that Valentine's Day would come around. I'm going to end up paying for it, but I don't know who the woman is yet most of the time.
Yeah.
And then I could tell at the back of my mind, I was kind of pissed off because I'm like, this is a pretty goddamn expensive. But if I've already got like $200 sitting there, I'm not mad or anything, right? Like
waiting. Yeah.
Yeah. Not only do you get a free meal with Andrew Heaton, he's not going to resent it for you if you don't put out. How great's that? And I've got like the same thing with my taxes. I think it's like I've got an estimated 20% of every Patreon thing that goes into that. And then this is where I get really devious. I have an old account that I kept that's unrelated to my current account. And that's where my actual savings are because I can't remember the password to it. I know I can access it if I want to, but I can't remember it off the top of my head. And it's just irritating enough that I never go into it. So I'm never tempted to go, I'm a little bit behind on the credit card this month. I'll just pull money from over there. No, I have to panic every month to pay off my credit card, but I don't end up touching the savings, which are currently being eaten away by inflation. Thanks, Uncle Sam.
So have you filed for an extension as the deadline approaches here? This is our tax day episode.
By the time the episode comes out, I hope to God I will have. I believe the filing extension is due like the 18th or the 19th this year. So I will do that at this time of recording here shortly, although in Oklahoma, where I own that 2% of a duplex in Jowls County, Oklahoma automatically files an extension if you file a federal extension, and Texas has no income tax. So I just have to file the federal one, and then I should be good.
I have to say that there, you know, I made it. I got my word back because we hire a tax guy and he's a very nice man. But this time he for the first time, he said, "Are you ready for the number?" And then he gave a pregnant pause and then said, "It's a big one." And then told me the number. And the joke I made to our friend Brian and Andrew Main was just a gif of me. Like on a big fun river day last summer. So shirtless, two thumbs up, slowly morphing into Rush Limbaugh. Like that's what getting that number made me feel like. I don't know. I guess I have a bit of a complicated feeling about taxes because on one hand, look, you made the money. That's good, right? You know that this is something that my wife and I are doing financially well enough that we can pay it. But oh boy, it just wow. Like when you grow up, you have these relationships with numbers. Like I remember in the game of life, the highest amount of money that you could earn was $100,000, like in that version that I remember. Right. So I've always pinned in my head, if you make $100,000 a year, you're doing the best in the game of life, at least in the board game of life. And you know, boy, as those as that tax number approaches closer and closer to those higher yearly incomes in the game of life, I feel a certain way about it, Heaton. I'm telling you.
You know, it's, I was talking to a guy about this last night here in Austin, and he pointed out to me, I think the numbers are correct on this, although I've not scoped them out for myself, that there is this electoral shift that happens demographically for a significant amount of Americans, somewhere between the age of like 28 and 35, where like it's everybody leaving high school is a progressive Democrat. And then right about the time they get a mortgage and start paying taxes, they become a lot more skeptical of the idea of just tax people to buy stuff from the government. And I'm like, yeah, that tracks. I get that. Like the equation always changes when you've got skin in the game, right?
Yes.
Like you might, maybe sometime you should have on my friend Maxim Lott. He runs electionbettingodds.com. I know we've talked about that. And like they're different than polls, because when you ask people who's going the primary, they're like, ah, Bernie Sanders or Mitt Romney or Jeb Bush. They're like, you want to put $8 on that? They're like, no, I don't want to do that. Like, if you're putting $8 on it, what are you going to do? Oh, yeah, Joe Biden, for sure. Yeah. And you see, I mean, like, St. Milton Friedman, peace be upon him, talked about how, you know, there's a like there's a different if you're buying lunch with your money versus you're buying lunch on a credit card from a company, or you're buying lunch for somebody else in the credit card for a company, that's probably going to influence what you have for lunch to some extent. Like that skin in the game does influence things.
How do you think we do with taxes here in the good old US of A, Heaton?
Okay, so I am not going to play the card you're probably anticipating, which is I'm not going to play the angry, curmudgeonly libertarian card.
Yeah.
Which,
by the way, before we get into this, we've talked about, you know, the business of being in independent media and specifically for you who has built a brand through Reason and a lot of these other libertarian leaning outlets. Periodically, you will be approached to either do benefits or short films or various different things by libertarian money people who are like, oh, there's money to do it. I now know exactly the moment that they're carving it out of their budget to be like, they're looking at their tax bill and they're like, no, you want to know what? 25% of this to propaganda to make sure this never happens again every year until it stops.
Yeah, I could see that being a thing. Unfortunately, as the hilarious Fred Willard of free market economics that I am, I don't know really enough about taxes to be a curmudgeon about it the way I am with like Euclidean zoning ordinances and occupational licensing, which I have a very strong feeling on. So when it comes to taxes, I get pretty whimsical and esoteric real quick. Broadly speaking, my position on taxes, I imagine, is that of most of the people listening to the show, which is we want a government. We're arguing about how big we want the government and how active we want the government to be. And in my case, I'd say if you're going to take somebody's money without their consent, you're going to force them to do it, then the onus is on you to show that there is an overwhelming public need for their money and that the solution you're proposing is going to be efficacious in resolving that need. If you can hit those two bars, I'm on board. So I don't have a problem with a concept of taxes. I do think that the ways we administer them could probably be pretty screwed up. There's probably a lot of inefficiencies. There's certainly a lot of things that I don't like. Like I do get pissed off with regressive taxes very much. Like between you and me and all of my best friends here, I don't know that I'm going to bother registering my car in Texas. And that's nothing against Texas. It's just I know it's bullshit. It's just a way to tax poor people. That's what that dinky little tag you put on your car is. It's not that they care if your car is safe or not. We don't in Oklahoma, they don't check your car if it's safe. In Texas, they do. But that's probably just a handout to automotive companies. They're just doing it because it's easier to tax poor people than rich people. And so if you do things that are consumption based, so that stuff irritates me. Where I get real whimsical, Justin, is I do think that there would be better ways more just and more effective ways to do taxes than our current system. And we came so close, Justin. There was a movement called the Georgists. Are you familiar with them?
I'm not familiar with the Georgists, no.
Oh, good. So Heaton gets to get into archaic, not pertinent tax history. This is great. I'm so excited.
Listeners, let me also say that unironically, while he was saying that, Heaton was rubbing his hands together as if he were about to have his favorite meal.
Uh-huh. So I learned about the Georgists from my friend Dominic Frisby, who's a comedian and financial analyst in London. Great guy and a really fun guest, by the way. He wrote a book called Daylight Robbery that I interviewed him about on the Political Orphanage about a year ago now, which is kind of just the history of taxation, which sounds so boring. I recognize that. It's actually fascinating because you think about like the sheer amount of civilization that's been affected by taxes. Like, here's one. Our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ was born in Bethlehem because there was a Roman census that they were doing to the entire empire to more effectively tax it. He would have been born in, like, I don't know, Guthrie or Ohio or something if it hadn't been
sure,
for that.
Normally, yeah.
Or alternately, most of us have surnames. The reason you and I have a last name is because some state, in my case, England, went, we need to figure out how to get these people to pay taxes better, right? So it is a fascinating book. He turned me on to the concept of Georgists. And what Georgists wanted to do was Georgists were this kind of interesting this is my take on it. Georgists are super capitalist from the ground up and kind of Marxist from the ground down. And so the way Georgists looked at things was if you build a business on top of a plot of land, we don't want to tax you on that. You built that. That's yours. Your labor went into that, your capital, you accepted the risk for all those things. So like if you have a business that's outperforming the business next door, we don't actually want to charge you more than the guy next door because we don't want to penalize you. We don't want to penalize success. We think that you deserve to keep the fruit of your labors, right? Conversely, if your plot of land happens to be on an oil field, well, you didn't do anything to build that oil field or to build the oil underneath it. It's not your cleverness or risk or innovation that is giving you that. You either lucked out or you purchased it through some method, but you're not responsible for that oil, right? Or conversely, let's say you're in New York City and you buy a business that is on the corner of a subway stop. That's going to get a ton of foot traffic. Well, you're benefiting from something that society built that you did not build yourself. And so the Georgists went, we want to tax people based on the value of the land as opposed to their income, which I think is actually a much more I now have a dog.
That's fine.
Which I think is a much more just and efficacious way of dealing out taxes. Now, if we had switched to that system and we came kind of close. I want to say like the 1880s, even like Churchill was flirting with it at one point. We came kind of close to it. But the benefit would be, I think you would find people that are, to quote former President Obama or paraphrase President Obama, the people who didn't build that would be taxed appropriately for the things that they didn't build. And meanwhile, the things you did build, you're not going to get in trouble for. No one's going to John Lovitz went on a rant about how much he pays in taxes for his comedy club a few years ago. And like people started speculating he was conservative because he was really pissed off. And he was talking about how hard he worked and how many hours he put in and the government would just come in and take his money. And I'm like, yeah, I think that's fair. I think that that's a fair rant. But conversely, Oklahoma, where I'm from, there's plenty of money in Oklahoma to pay for stuff. Like the actual amount of money coming out of the ground from oil is incredible. And yet we've got like counties that have full-time schooling 3 or 4 days a week because we can't afford to pay the teachers. I'm like, well, why don't we – if we were smart about this, we'd done it from scratch. I would have done a Georgia system and said taxes are going to be paid through land value and we're not going to charge anybody income or bullshit regressive sales taxes and things like that either.
And so that way you would be getting the money from people for whom are deriving
exactly.
Deriving value from the land that they are on. And so therefore, if you don't own land, you are living a tax-free lifestyle.
Yeah.
If you own land that is – you're incentivized to own land that is not particularly valuable and create a ground-up value on top of it.
Exactly. And I think you would find that it would actually be much more beneficial to most people. So like, for example, one of the criticisms I had that I brought up with Dominic Frisbee was like, you know, I've got farmer family. This sounds like it would penalize them because you got to have a lot of land for those cows and that alfalfa. Uncle Dan goes out and mows the corn every day. He's got all that land. Well, the thing is, farmland's not valuable, like compared to like city land. Like here in Austin, where you and I live, the land is far more valuable by any metric than it is at farms two counties over, right? Like if you were essaying that the value of that land, you would go, oh, we're going to charge you like $5 an acre if it's just an alfalfa field. Meanwhile, if you've got, you know, oil underneath it or something like that. But yes, basically the idea would be you are being taxed on things that you were benefiting from either by natural splendor that you did not create or by societal confluence that you did not create. And that's what you're being taxed on, for the privilege of using those things.
Yeah.
And I think that would be better. The other benefit to that system, too, is when you get into it, there's a ton of money up in land ownership. Like the person on the planet that has the most land is the Queen of England. She has a ton of land. And then you can even make a distinction beyond that of the crown, as in the institution, is the biggest real estate holder on earth. And a lot of the time, they're not paying taxes on these things. The Queen's not paying taxes on all of her land.
Weird.
If you were to do this in, weird, huh? If you were to set this up, now, if you switched over to this system, what you'd find is a lot of people that own a ton of land that are able, like, let's say a lot of these agribusinesses that are getting tons, like millions and millions of dollars from the federal government because they own so much acreage, which is what we pay out farm subsidies on, they now have to go, oh, how much of this land do we actually want, and sell it back and focus on the things that are economically productive. So I think it would be a good system. So if we ever build a moon base,
I'm
there.
Immediately now in my head, in our alternate universe in which we created a Georgia system, becoming a lobbyist for the tax assayers for these oil companies, in which I just have to explain to you. Now, look, everybody that's getting clean oil, tax them, but us, we're getting trash oil. This is very bad oil. Like so we need a new classification for trash oil, because that needs to be taxed less than old good oil McGee down the road.
I think you're 100%. That is exactly what happens right now. And there's a brilliant method to countermand that. May I put a thought in your head?
Please go ahead.
Okay.
Ruin my day on Fantasy K Street.
Right. Anybody that gets off on pretending to be a lobbyist needs a better hobby. I interviewed another fellow a few months later named Glenn Weil, very smart guy. Glenn Weil has proposed a system of taxation, or I guess a system of tax assessment, which is a self-assessed auction tax. Now, this is how this would work. We're going to carve out some stuff here. You can't take somebody's house or their car or their personal objects, their clothes and things like that, right? But when we're talking about commercial property, where we're talking about things that are obvious moneymakers, however you want to define that, in this theoretical example of the oil company that has the oil field and they're going, our oil's very salty, we shouldn't have to pay as much as the other oil field. Rather than having a tax assessor come in and say, we've determined that your land is worth X amount, those guys say how much their land is worth. They get to pick it. They say, we say it's $1 million, and there's a flat rate for everything, right? Like it's, I don't know, let's say 12%. Your mileage could vary.
Yeah.
12%, right? Here's the deal. You say, we've decided our land's worth $1 million and we're going to pay 12%. Or you could go, we only think it's worth $400,000. We're going to pay 12%. But you have to sell it at that price if a bidder comes up to you. So if you want to lowball it and go, we don't want to pay that much taxes this year. Let's just say it's worth $500,000. And some guy goes, this is easily worth more than $500,000. I will gladly pay 12% taxes on that for $500,000. Comes up, buys it from you. You just lost that money. And so that kind of system,
in that situation, you're not compelled to sell it, but you would have to wait the next year that you would reassess. So you would stop yourself from a hot market if one emerged.
I think you'd have to have some kind of thing in there. I mean, Glenn would say that because you were basically saying this is the price that I'm telling you is the price that I would gladly sell it for.
Yeah.
That it would not then matter how often this happened. That if you're an oil company, people keep buying your oil fields, but you're making a profit every time. Congratulations, you just became an oil real estate company. He would say that from where I'm at, it would make sense to me to have like a 6 month or year long lag time where I can come up at any time, make this bid, and go, "Hi, I see that you registered. You've got this corn farm that you said is worth, $400,000. I'm going to purchase this. You now have 8 months, or however we do it." And the way you'd factor this in is, again, you would go, if somebody comes and tries to buy this corn farm from under me, how much am I willing to sell it for where I would not be screwed over and I would have the capital left over to go start something else? Like, so you would build that in. But the result is there's really not a lot of wiggle room for tax evasion under this system, because you're saying literally what you think the value of the land is based on what you'd be willing to part with it on. So you're really not going to lowball it, because somebody might come in and buy it out from under you, and you have no incentive to highball it because you're going to be paying higher taxes. I think that would actually work, by the way, because this is another like, where the hell is this going to happen? Where this kind of system would work would be like less pertinent now, but radio bandwidths, which are, you know, mm-hmm. effectively something that the government has to allocate. That's the kind of thing we could do this with, going like, "Hey, NPR, you get to have your bandwidth, but it's an auction system. And if Fox wants to come in and do it or whatever, like because this is effectively a public good," or I shouldn't use that. That's a weird economic. Yeah, I guess that would apply economically. It's a public good. It's something that's accessible to everybody. You could do that. The other one would be whenever you're privatizing an industry, this would be the kind of thing you could do that with. So like when the Soviet Union collapsed, rather than Yeltsin and Putin just giving it out to their buddies, this would have been a more judicious way of allocating those former state resources. Or like, I don't know what Margaret Thatcher, peace be upon her, did when she privatized all the coal industries and some of the train industries in the United Kingdom. I don't know whether she just gave everybody a rebate or whether she auctioned the companies off. But that to me would seem like a time where that would kind of work, of like, now the British coal company is in this auction system. And if somebody comes up and wants to pay whatever you guys dictate it, they can do it and the ownership can switch.
All right, last question here, because we are in this 1099 lifestyle for which we are deducting a bunch of stuff. Taxes are Byzantine. They're weird. They are you are constantly under threat of a system for which nobody is directly telling you at the point of submission that you've done something wrong. And yet the state reserves the right to come back, comb through not only that year's finances, but previous year's finances, mm-hmm. where they can ask for more money and you have to fight about it. Tax reform as a political issue is one of those strange ones that, like infrastructure, when you talk to people, it is bipartisan mm-hmm. in its popularity. The people are for it. They think mm-hmm. that taxes are too complicated. They want a simpler format to do it. They find it very stressful. They don't like having to pay extra money to pay a shaman to tell them that they are doing things the right way. And yet it never happens, mm-hmm. largely because it's not a particular, while it's a good bipartisan idea, it very rarely becomes something that is an exciting thing for bureaucrats to cut through. And also the people that are really, really into it tend to not be the most popular or charismatic politicians.
Yeah.
But
I am a rarity of, I'm going to go out on a limb and say I've been engaging with tax ideology, but I'm a rarity in that regard. And hats off to my friend Dominic Frisbee.
Yeah. Do you think that we will ever get to a point where our American tax system is at least simplified? Because every solution that you have given, while mm-hmm. it may or may not be more equitable and where it may or may not be taxing the quote unquote right people, all of your solutions are very simple. You say a thing, that's how much you pay. Do you own land? Yes. Okay. There's a few more steps. If the answer is no, which is a lot of people, congratulations, you don't pay taxes. Like all of these things are designed to simplify. Do you think we will ever see that here?
No, I think the only situation where I could really see that happening is if you have like a total game changer where like Bitcoin becomes the international reserve currency and like to some extent taxation is actually voluntary because people are just getting their money in Bitcoin and not really. Something like that. Then I could see the government going, all right, we got to be more simple here if we're actually going to make any money. But no, I don't think so. I think for two reasons. One, the biggest one, let's say 80% of this is I would assume there's a very strong TurboTax lobby or some equivalent of accountants that want to keep it Byzantine in order to create work for themselves. My guess would be that is the case. Scott Adams coined the term confusopoly a few years ago, which is when an industry becomes intentionally obtuse in order to
create jobs.
Dissuade. Yeah, in order to create jobs and dissuade competition. But then on top of that, now that I've been a 1099 guy that's self-employed, I now understand that this isn't the kind of thing that you could just automatically do. So like when I go over in the UK, my British friends like laugh at us because we have to fill out our own taxes. My British friends don't do that. Their boss just tells them you pay this much in taxes this year. I don't even know if they mail it in. They're informed, right? And I'm like, that sounds great, but like think about if you actually run a business, somebody has to determine what is a legitimate business expense or not. So like for example, I've purchased this equipment that I'm talking to you on. Well, that's clearly a legitimate business expense. I need to be able to write that off.
We are businessing right now.
Yeah. But conversely, what about clubs? Like if I join the Friars Club, that's a couple thousand dollars a year. It's a bunch of comedians. That seems like it's good networking. All right. Well, what if I go to the country club? Because that now sounds like you're just giving me a tax exemption to hang out with other rich people that I was going to do anyway. Right. So like that kind of thing's always going to come up that gray area. And for that reason, I don't think it's ever going to completely be simplified unless we adopt a Georgist land value system.
I will say that the last time I talked about this, and it just came back to me while we were speaking, internationally was made fun of roundly, including New Zealand, where people were sending me their international tax returns to show me it is one page front, not even front and back, just front. Right. But a lot of it comes from government involvement in the banks, which is something that I think Americans would very much push up against because, you know, we don't want anybody poking around where they don't necessarily need to be.
There's the automatic deduction you can do. I can't remember what that's set at now. Automatic money back thing that everybody gets the option of. It's like $6,000 or whatever it is. Like for if you're those folks where you're in a W-2, that would make sense to me. I would want that simplified thing. For me as an independent business owner, I would prefer to continue writing off my microphone and all the books I buy and all that stuff.
And every time that we go to lunch and
every time we go to lunch and discuss business as we do,
which, I mean, to be fair, we don't have lives outside of our work. So it's 90% of what we talk about.
Happen to interview a lot of the waitresses over at Smokey Joe's Dance Pole. That could be related to my business.
You earned it, tax man. You earned it.
And I'm paid in cash when I dance at Smokey Joe's Dance Pole. So maybe I don't report that.
Ladies and gentlemen, Andrew Heaton, the Political Orphanage, having ourselves a cathartic tax day chat. Thank you so much, man.
You are so welcome. And for anybody that wants to check him out, Google the Political Orphanage and Dominic Frisbee or Glenn Weil, and you could hear extended tax episodes about these subjects. Always a pleasure. Thank you, Justin.
Politics, Politics, Politics is written and hosted by me, Justin Robert Young, for Dog and Pony Show Audio in Austin, Texas. This show was edited by Brett Stewart. If you would like to thank Andrew Heaton for coming on the show, head on over to px3guest.com, letter P, letter X, number 3, guest.com. And, of course, you can always send us an email, theyoungamerican@gmail.com. Find us on Twitter, px3tweets. I'm live on Twitch at px3live.com every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday morning, Central Time. And you can share this podcast with your friends and family, px3podcast.com. Our merch can be found at politicsmerch.com. If you'd like to support us with a one-time donation, you can do so, paypal.me/payjury. Our Venmo is justin-young-20, and our Cash App is px3cash. If you'd like to send me anything in the mail, gifts, perishables, fiat currency, do so at P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas 78715. Again, that is P.O. Box 153184, Austin, Texas 78715. If you want exclusive content, the only place you can go is TakePoliticsSeriously.com. $3 tier gets you 2 bonus podcasts per week covering all the news that we miss on our free podcast schedule. And the $10 tier gets your name read at the end of the podcast like these fine folks in the Titanic. $10 tier. By the way, go to your email right now. This is the last time we're going to read these nicknames. New nicknames are already coming in, but I want to give you guys a full couple days to answer your email, a full weekend to answer your email. Make sure you get your new nicknames in there, in here, if you are part of the $10 tier. They, for the last time possibly, will read as follows. Persons familiar with the matter, Andres on safe DB levels, Idris Arslanian, DJ Katie Mac, Niemeister, Dr. G, Admiral Flapjack, Utah Jimmy Montana, Edmund Pluribus Unum, Pete Spicety, 70s TV Salesman of Spire. D, really? And Gloria Young for King of the New World Order. Zombie Doc Edison, no mention of the podcast. Please.com, Junkie, DP4, Bongo, Jewish Lives Matter, 100 Mile Runner, Staff Sergeant Poopers, Berkeley, Steven, Diana, Silent Slumbers, Katie, Adam L., Double K Ranch, The Old Pinball Shop, John, The Opposable Thumbs for Dogs Foundation, Super Zoomy, Neil, Charles, Darren, Olin and Angela, DL, Steven, Chad, Matt, Miranda, Janelle, Chief Andy, Robert, Casey, Paul, Dustin, Richard, D-Laser, Just Another Pilot, my boy, Middle-Aged Mike, The Gen, J-Pink, and Andrew. You want your name read alongside them? Well, just head on over. TakePoliticsSeriously.com. Heading out to Ohio next week, we will also have an interview with the cosmic Kevin Ryan, who, you know, he's a busy man. He's got a lot on his plate. He's got a new kid on the way. He doesn't write as often as I want him to write. I want him to write constantly. But he wrote an essay about the concept of community, spirituality, just a lot that blew my mind. I love his writing. We're going to talk. I know some of you guys, you rejoice when Kevin and I get going. I feel like you're going to really like this one because this one is very spacey and I'm in love with it. Till then, this is your old pal, Justin Robert Young, saying, some shows talk about politics, others talk about politics, and still more discuss politics. But this is the only show that dares discuss all three!
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.